Andrew Fisher is Architectura. Before Architectura's inception as one of the nation's leading design and furniture showrooms, Andrew was a woodworker and a furniture maker. His path to woodworking started early in his childhood when he began building things alongside his grandfather. But those early days left an indelible mark, and he followed his passions well into his 20s, completing his studies at the influential art and design school, Cranbrook. In this interview, we hear about Andrew's path to furniture making, his passion for music, and his experiences at Cranbrook that shaped what Architectura is today. This is part one of a two-part interview that is brought to you by Architectura. More than a collection, a conviction. Okay, why don't we start at the beginning?
The very beginning.
You were born in Rochester, but you grew up in Grosse Pointe?
Yeah, Grosse Pointe, Michigan.
Is that the same Grosse Pointe as the film Grosse Pointe Blank?
Yes, ma'am, it's the same film. It's where my dad grew up, my grandfather grew up, and so, you know, we moved back to Grosse Pointe when I was young and moved in with my grandparents and lived with my grandparents while my father went on the mission of dating and meeting another woman. And then once he met someone, we moved out into another house, into a house that he bought.
But you remained, now you had to meet another woman because your mom passed away. You remained very close to your grandparents. In fact, my recollection is that your grandfather was quite the inspiration for you.
Oh, for sure. He was, both my grandfathers actually were, I was close to both of them. They, for some reason, they really took an interest in me and at a young age. More so, well, not totally, but more so than my mother's mother. She didn't take as much interest, but my grandfather really did, and we spent a lot of time together when I would see him in the summers.
And what were the ways in which he inspired you?
I think just by his mannerisms and by his way and how he related and interacted with me and with other people. And when you're young, you're absorbing all that. And he was the first person who introduced me to the shop, because he had a shop at his Pennsylvania home.
And your stepmom, were you close to her?
Not so much.
Hmm. And did she stay your stepmom for a long time?
Yeah, all the way through my life. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'd love for you to share the story of the shop and your first times of getting into the shop in Pennsylvania. I crafted this image in my mind of it being in the woods, but I think that's actually part of something later in your life.
No, it was suburban, and it was a house that my grandfather had built, and downstairs he had a little shop. It was maybe 300 feet, square feet, and he had his, you know, table saw and bandsaw and the tools. And he would go down there, and I don't know exactly what he would do. He'd just go down there and be working on stuff, probably the house. And so to keep me occupied at, you know, an age of, I don't know, 8, something like that, he would, you know, I'd follow him around. We'd go out and burn the trash in the backyard. We'd go out and shoot the little pellet gun at the crows, you know, to get them out of the backyard. We would, you know, he'd take me down the shop. And I just wanted to be with him. Actually, I just kind of hung out with him. And so in the shop, you know, he would, while he was working, he'd say, oh, here's a couple pieces of wood, a couple nails, a hammer, you know, do something. So, of course, you just, as a kid, you just, like, grab the nails and start pounding, you know, and you smash your fingers a few times, and you do those kind of things. And he would help me come over, maybe shape a little something this or shape a little something that, or why don't we do this or why don't we do that? And eventually we kind of morphed this little, I remember it was like a freighter or something, because I lived in Grosse Pointe where I grew up in the Lake St. Clair, where there's a lot of freighters, so it must have been on my mind or something. And so he helped me craft that. And that was kind of the first, and that feeling, you know, the amazing feeling of it being finished and looking at it and holding it was the absolute first time that I had that overwhelming sense of accomplishment, that I had actually accomplished something.
Having something tangible, having thought of something and then turned it into something real.
Right.
And your grandpa must have been pretty proud of you, too.
I think so. I don't really remember that being the case. It may for him just been like, hey, that's really great. Okay, let's go. We got to go get some lunch or whatever it is. But for me, it was quite a bit more monumental.
I mean, do you think it was kind of a turning point for you where it was what ultimately made you decide to get into furniture?
I don't know. I don't think it was conscious. I think it was just a feeling. It was an experience, and that experience I carried with me, which later on, when I found myself in a similar situation, provoked that emotion, and I remembered it, and maybe carried forward with that.
Yeah, I think that's perfectly said. It isn't conscious, but it's resonant, for sure.
Yeah.
And I got a little bit confused. You were not living in Pennsylvania at that time?
No, I would just go there in the summers for a couple weeks at a time.
Why did your grandparents move there?
Well, that was my mother's parents, and so they lived there. That's where they grew up and lived.
Oh, okay. So it was your maternal grandfather.
Right.
Yeah. So when did you kind of start doing more of that, more of working in the shop?
It happened in high school. And I remember in middle school kind of looking into the metal shop windows and seeing these guys working. I thought, oh, that's kind of cool. But at that point, I was pretty heavily into, you know, playing my guitar and writing songs and hanging out with my friends and didn't really pay a lot of attention to it. But when we got to high school, there was mandatory electives. You had to take your electives, right? So I took art and I took wood shop. And in the wood shop, in the beginning, it was really kind of, you know, amateurish, sophomoric stuff. You know, we'd be pounding away on birdhouses and cutting boards and things like that. But I started to get this feeling. I really liked it. You know, it was a great feeling. But essentially, I took it because my friends were taking it also, and we wanted a place to goof off, and we knew we could goof off there. Well, it turns out we couldn't goof off there, actually, at all. Because Mr. Reams, the instructor, was such a badass. You know, this guy, here we are in the suburbs of Grosse Pointe, and this guy had slick back hair like Elvis and wore cowboy boots.
No.
You know, yeah, and no one wore cowboy boots then, right? And he would kick you right in the ass, you know, if you were fooling around, right? So he was a badass. He would not put up with a lot of our stuff.
That's great.
Yeah, so we started spending time there. And then one by one, I think some of my friends kind of fell out. But I was really kind of getting into it. And Mr. Reams saw that I was getting into it and somehow took a little bit of interest in me and would take me over to the lathe and show me how to use the lathe. And because it was an advanced thing. And so he would take me to the lathe, show me how to use the lathe. And then he'd say, now sweep it up, you know, because you had to clean your mess up, right? There was always this, like, consequence to everything. And so that's – and then I started having these feelings. I started finding myself going back there during my off periods or instead of eating lunch, going to the wood shop. Or after school, he would let me come there for an hour or two, you know, while something else was going on. I can't remember all the details of that, but I was in there a lot. I just started spending more and more time in there.
Amazing. You fell in love with it. And what about music? Was that just kind of growing concurrently?
Yeah, exactly at the same time. We had the band. And the funny thing is I was building speaker cabinets in the wood shop for the band. And, you know, it's kind of the crossover language between the two. I was always intermixing them. And they both brought me the same that same connection to a deeper self that I didn't have day to day, but every once in a while I would get there. And those two places somewhat consistently took me there.
And do you find any similarity between music and woodworking?
Oh, I've never really thought of that. Is there similarity? I mean, it's a similarity in the sense that I need to get into the zone to do that work at a higher level. I mean, at a lower level, it's just hacking away, either on the guitar or in the shop. But on a more advanced level, an intellectual level, a conscious level, it requires a bit of a transformation to move into that zone to be able to function in a linear manner and connect the dots one at the other. And also leave room for the accidental interpretation, which can happen.
Which can always sometimes be the best.
Oftentimes is the best.
The accidents.
Yeah.
So those two were growing concurrently. You had a band. What kind of music were you guys playing?
We were into the, I don't know, the Birds and the Beatles and the Grateful Dead. We loved the Grateful Dead, and we loved country rock. We loved the whole California sound, you know, so we were, of course, emulating that because we thought we were counterculture. And
what year was this?
72.
And did you go to any Dead shows?
Yeah, I saw plenty of Dead shows.
Really? Did you at all? Did you ever follow the Dead?
Yeah, I followed the Dead a little bit.
Really? Yes. You're turning red just talking about
it. Sorry,
it's
kind of funny.
Why? Is it embarrassing or is it just... Because that's a kind of a cool thing to do. It's something that...
Yeah, but it does have a connotation of, you know, drop out, I guess, in a way, and you know, heavy drug use and things like that.
Did you have long hair then?
Yes, very long hair.
Really?
Yeah.
Long red flowing hair?
Yeah, that's right.
And would you have to pull it back in the wood shop, like in a ponytail or something?
Yeah. Yep.
Interesting. Yeah. It is interesting. Adds to the imagery. So anyway, so you worked in the wood shop all throughout high school.
Right.
What were some of your best accomplishments there?
I think the what felt like the best accomplishments were the tables that I was making for my parents. Although at the time, it just felt somewhat like a nuisance that I had to make these tables for my parents because my dad wanted them. But now thinking back, I was actually quite pleased, and they were quite pleased with them, so that it did have a little bit of a feedback loop of connection with my parents.
And I know, I can only imagine how proud they must have been to have something made by their son.
You would never know that in that generation, right?
Really, yeah.
Yeah, people didn't use those words.
Yeah. Now, were these dining tables or were these side tables?
Side tables.
Yeah, so they would have them in their bedroom.
Yeah, and out by their chair where they would, you know, watch football and put their drink and whatever.
Do they still exist, you know?
I don't know. I don't know. They might. One or two might still exist.
And where would they be?
They would be up in a condominium at a retirement community in Harbor Springs where my mom was living and passed away. And mm-hmm. then we still own that unit, and we rent it out furnished, so it could be in there.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It'd be good to go and retrieve those as the sort of archive.
Yeah, I guess so.
So when you left high school, what was the plan? I mean, how did you? What direction did you want to take? You had these two options: music or furniture.
When I left high school, the plan was, I don't know, and the direction was, I don't know. So what I did with my friends is we continued to play in the band, and we had our girlfriends and we had our lives and we would do what we normally did. And I went to the community college, Macomb Community College, where we tried to figure it out. And I don't know why, but things came easy for me there. All of a sudden I was writing papers and getting good grades and things started to happen. I knew at that time it wasn't going to be a long-term endeavor.
The community college?
Yeah, the community college. And so one of my good friends, says, I'm going out to San Francisco. I'm going to go to the San Francisco Art Institute. I'm like, wow, that's incredible. Isn't that where, like, the Jefferson Airplane and the Moby Grape and the Grateful Dead and Creedence Clearwater Revival are? I mean, come on. And he's like, yeah, man, it's happening there.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wow. He says, you got to come. I'm like, yeah, I got to go to San Francisco. I'd never been to San Francisco. And I thought to myself, that's kind of cool. So I said to my dad, I said, well, I want to go to San Francisco and study furniture. And he kind of looked at me like.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, right. Why San Francisco and why furniture, right?
Yeah.
And I said, well, I want to study furniture because it's something that I really love and I want to do. And you know, I think it's really great. And at that point, I must have been moving into that space. I knew we weren't going to make it as musicians. There's no way. It was just a very crowded field, and I don't know if we had the discipline. And so I really kind of sold my dad on the idea that I wanted to go to San Francisco. And he kept asking me, well, isn't there another school in, like, Michigan or something? And I kept saying, no, Dad, this is it. I mean, this is the school. And I had researched it. There's a school, Laney College. Laney College had a really good wood shop. And so I convinced him into it. And he somehow, I don't know why or how, he said, okay. And so I said, okay, I'm going to San Francisco with my friend. And we moved out here, and I lived in these dorms at Lone Mountain College, which is now USF. The dorms were for all the students in San Francisco that didn't have dorms, all the schools, like the Art Institute, the Academy of Music, or all these different, you know, creative schools. So the dorms were filled with these creative people, floor after floor. I came from a fairly conservative, suburban place. I had never seen anything like it, never saw anything like it. It was the most amazing experience. All of a sudden, I'm surrounded by all these people speaking multiple languages and multiple sexual orientations, and we're just having the time of our life every single day. We're just hanging out, having dinners, talking, hanging out all the time. And it was a real eye-opening experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's the ideal college experience.
Right. And I think so, too. For me, it was not planned. It just appeared. And I guess that's what friendships do, right? Friendships lead you on journeys. And this particular friend led me on a journey to San Francisco.
Do you still know him?
Oh, yeah.
Where is he now?
Los Angeles.
And is he an artist and a creative person?
He's a film, well, he's a film producer and a film editor.
Oh, so yeah.
Yeah.
He kept with it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I stayed with it.
Yeah, I remember talking about those dorms. Did you have a beautiful view?
Oh, the view was insane. You could see all the way over the Presidio, all the way around to past the Transamerica building. It was the most... it was just mind-blowing. And every day we would sit, we'd actually climb up on the roof of this thing, which in hindsight was so dangerous. I can't believe we did it. It's like a, you know, a tile roof. We're up there on this roof. Insane. And watch the fog come in. It would just roll right over the Golden Gate Bridge. If you come from Michigan, you're just not quite prepared for something like that.
Must have been just so extraordinary.
It was. I mean, but at 18, do you really know it? I don't know. You know, I mean, I know now how extraordinary it was. I remember feeling how great and cool it was. So, I mean, it must have been.
And music, were you still doing that?
Not really. I had my guitar, but I really wasn't playing it that much. I was, at that point, started to spend a lot of time at Laney, and then the Bolinas Craftsman Guild opened up. I heard about that, and I started to, like, kind of hang around that whole scene. And just pursue this designer craftsman furniture movement, which appeared out of nowhere for me, and I immediately fell in love with it and started to, you know, hang out with the people that were doing it or wanting to do it.
So how long did you stay in San Francisco? Did you fall in love with the city?
Yeah, I fell in love with it. I had a little apartment on Euclid Street after I moved out. The first semester I moved out to this little apartment. It was great. And I fell totally in love with it. So I ended up just absorbing everything I could about San Francisco.
So you stayed here for about 9 months?
Yeah.
And then you left?
Yeah.
Wow, that must have been hard to leave.
It was really hard to leave. And looking back, I realized more things happened in those 9 months of my life than perhaps 10 years of my life now. Just the concentration of new experiences and you know, new people, and it was amazing.
Yeah, but you know, you can recreate that by meeting new people or extending beyond the boundaries of what you normally do day to day. But it's hard to do that when you're so busy.
Yeah, when you have a family and you have kids and you have a business and you need to exercise, you know, and you want to do your own hobbies, yeah, there's not that much time left over.
That's true. So you moved, and where did you go?
Moved back to Michigan, to Marquette, Michigan, northern in the UP, and went to Northern Michigan University. There was a shop there, a really nice shop again. I don't know how I ended up in this. It must have been the period of time. There must have been some conscious effort by the states to invest into the applied arts or something, because I'm at Northern, and now there's another beautiful shop, a beautiful shop. Mm. I'm like, how could that even possibly be? But it was. It was great. It was really beautiful. But I was really distraught when I got up there, because it is the antithesis of San Francisco. And the people, most of the people around, were coming from a very different perspective. And I felt very much like odd man out.
Mm-hmm. When you saw San Francisco, it was around the first time my mom had ever seen it. And she fell in love with it, and nothing else could compare.
Yeah, it was a maybe it was post-60s and there was a calm. I'm not sure. It didn't feel as crazy as you know, I had read over and over. But it was a really peaceful place.
Mm-hmm. But now you're in the UP, which is the Upper Peninsula. What's that? What's the Upper Peninsula like?
It's rugged, rough. It's like Maine, actually.
Yeah.
A lot like Maine.
So beautiful. Then.
Yeah, super beautiful. You know, yeah. Lake Superior is surrounded by Lake Superior in Lake Michigan. It's beautiful.
So it's gorgeous. And you were in this new university.
Right.
Were any of your friends there?
No.
Oh, my gosh. So why did you, I still don't understand why you moved.
My dad asked me to be closer to home. He had found out that, yes, there actually was a furniture program at Northern Michigan University. I didn't need to go all the way to San Francisco. I think my uncle was behind it. I think they were talking. They did some research to figure it out. And they figured out that, oh, guess what? There's a really good furniture program at Northern Michigan University. So you don't need to be in San Francisco. And he asked me to come back. And I couldn't really say no.
Yeah, and it turned out to work out.
How do you explain these journeys, right? How do you know ever if you're making the right decision?
Mm-hmm.
And in hindsight, it was the absolute most brilliant decision I ever made because it stepping stoned its way to where I am today.
Yeah, of course. And in the short term, it was a stepping stone to Cranbrook.
Well, that was not the intent.
I know,
any stretch of imagination, Cranbrook wasn't even on the radar in my mind.
Yeah.
You know, and it just kind of went that way.
So tell me about this shop. Was it in the woods?
Yeah, the shop, it was called the Bird's Eye Building. The Bird's Eye Building was in the woods. It was off campus. It was away from all the other people. So you were out there, you know, in the creative zone.
Did you spend a tremendous amount of time there?
Every minute. Because I didn't have any friends in the beginning. I had no friends. So my friends were the people in the shop. And we became close because there was a number of them that were also on the 24-hour program, you know, that we just worked and worked. And we loved everything about the shop. We loved the wood. We loved the tools. We loved everything. We loved it. We just loved it. It was our little private Idaho. And no one bugged us there. We just did whatever we wanted.
And you must have been about 20 years old.
Right, 20.
What kind of things were you making? Everything?
At that point, I was stepping it up because the instructor, Bill Lee, was a big kind of dude in the bent lamination world. And so he was, you know, kind of preaching bent lamination. And I jumped on that, and I started doing bent lamination products.
Which is like steam? Did that have to do with the steam?
Yeah, but not with steam, with glue and with a form and with jigs and clamps and wood and glue.
It's just amazing now that you talk about this with such reverence and yet you don't make anything anymore.
Just trying to get through the day.
I know, but I mean, it's just not lucrative. I mean, it's hard. It's a hard thing to pursue.
Well, if I didn't spend my time in the recording studio now, maybe I'd be working in a shop. But there's only so many hours in a day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I do fantasize about it. I fantasize about building a shop.
You don't long for it, though.
I do, but the ramp up is a lot. You know, if a shop mysteriously appeared right over there with all the tools in it and they didn't all need to be worked on every day and the wood was there, I'd be in there. But the ramp up is pretty big.
Mm-hmm. So you were, you know, building bent laminated pieces. Now, how about those? Do any of those exist anymore?
No.
How do you know?
Because I donated them.
Well, they exist somewhere. They're
somewhere, just, yeah.
Okay, who did you donate them to?
The Goodwill.
That's amazing. You didn't have enough attachment to your pieces that you just give it to Goodwill.
No, there was no place for me to keep them. There was no place for them to go. So I didn't want to hold on to them.
Yeah.
They had served their purpose.
I mean, 4 years working consistently in a shop, I mean, you must have really been an expert by the time you left.
Well, what is Malcolm Gladwell say? 10,000 hours, right? 10,000 hours to mastery. So I don't know how that breaks out. I felt like I had 10,000 hours in when I left there.
10,000 hours, yeah. Well, you've certainly clocked that.
I felt like I clocked it, for sure. It was a strange happenstance that led that from Northern to Cranbrook. You know, it was a really odd set of scenarios that I now look back on and think, I don't know. So I decided once I graduated, I had nowhere to go, zero. And I decided I was going to, like, hide out in the shop because I wanted the shop. I still wanted to work. I just didn't want to stop working in the shop. I couldn't stop. I was addicted, I guess. And so I kind of built a little, you know, a little room in the shop and moved my stuff in there and had a little hot plate and lived there illegally because the security would come through every night with their flashlights. And I actually made this little room and had a padlocked door on the outside and would leave the padlock locked and then skinny between the wall and the two walls to get into the space from the backside. So it would look like there was no one in there. But then they would come through every night and I would just kind of be super quiet and I'd be sleeping because they'd always come through at like 12 or something. So I knew what time they were going to come through. And I just shut everything down, turned the lights off, got in there, you know, to go to sleep. And sure enough, I never got caught. I parked my car elsewhere and they never caught me.
That's pretty amazing.
It is amazing.
You were trespassing.
Trespassing. I was a graduate, right? So it's a little bit gray. But no one was supposed to be in the shop, but I had a key. No one asked me for the key back. And so I just kind of kept on keeping on.
Did anyone know you were there ever?
I think a couple of my friends might have known I was there. I don't recall.
So it's where you were living?
I was living there. I had no other place to live.
You didn't want to go back home?
No, I was not going back home. No way.
I mean, they would have welcomed you, but you didn't want to.
That's correct.
So you graduated from the school.
Right.
You literally did not know where to go, so you set yourself up a little room in the shop.
Right. That's right.
At the age of like 22 or 23.
Right. 22, I guess, something like that. Maybe 23.
Wow. And how about in the day? Wasn't it a little suspicious that you were there during the day making stuff?
I don't know. No one bothered me. I was there all day just like planing away and cutting away and working away and nobody.
Did you sell any of these pieces that you would make?
Yeah, I had commissions, so I was making them and selling them, and that's, you know, so you had a little stream of money coming in.
So when did you get your first commission? I mean, aside from, you know, your parents in high school.
Oh, that right after high school, I was building speaker cabinets. These speaker cabinets for my friends.
When you were at this school in Michigan, who was commissioning you to do stuff?
Friends of my friends' parents. And I was also delivering pizzas to survive. And those people that own the pizza place commissioned me to do some work as well.
Interesting.
Yeah.
They felt, you know, they needed stuff and they also felt for you.
Yeah. Right. Well, they wanted something unique, right? So we'd talk about it and talk about it. And so there we'd have it. I'd go in the shop and make something and they loved it.
Really?
Yeah.
That's great. And what was the style? I mean, mid-century modern? Or
it was designer craftsman. It would have been kind of a organic, modern, maybe two sizes removed from the Scandinavian movement at that point.
Are you, now, when you look at that stuff, do you, at this age, does it appeal to you?
When I look at that particular movement that was going on?
That you were making, the things that you were making.
Well, you know, it's really hard because when they're yours, they take on a non-objective perspective. And it's the same thing with songs. It's like you almost can't critique your own work because you're too close to it. And because it's you, it's almost like you just kind of like it. And so I look at those pieces, and yes, I'm very proud of them. They're all photographed. They're all, you know, going to be on the new website or whatever, you know. And I'm proud of that work. I worked really hard to do it, really hard, to get that work out, and labored over it meticulously for months to make sure that it was perfect.
So then after Northern, what happened? You stayed in the shop, and how long did you live there?
For the summer. And, of course, there's a little bit of anxiety when you're living illegally, and you don't know where you're going to go and what's going to happen next. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't like I had this spiritual path like, oh, God will take care of me, or, you know, some higher power is going to intervene here. That was not where my head was at. And I was working in the shop. And back at this point, there were only regular landline phones. So there was one phone that was outside the shop door, and that's what everybody used to call the hardware store or to call the lumber yard or whatever. And it would ring all summer. It would ring. It would ring. It would ring at the weirdest times, you know, and I'd always look at the thing and like, yeah, I'm not going to answer that phone because
I'm not going to risk.
Yeah. And it isn't anybody I know, most likely. Of course, I wish it was like an old girlfriend or something calling, trying to reach me, but I wasn't going to bet on that. And one day in August, and I had come back to the shop, I remember I was just kind of milling around, and the phone rang. And I don't know, maybe because it was in August, it was near the end or something. I knew the end was coming because in a matter of a couple of weeks.
The students will be there.
Yeah, and I wasn't allowed to be there unless I was going to sign up for like more classes or something. And that would be kind of weird, I think. and so the phone rang, I picked it up. And I don't today, I don't know why. I have no idea why I picked that phone up. But I picked it up and there was this guy on the other end of the line, Kirby Smith. And it was Kirby Smith. He said, I'm Kirby Smith, and I graduated from Northern in the ceramics department, and I'm down here at the School of Cranbrook. I'm teaching ceramics down here, and we're looking for an instructor of woodworking. Can you please, you know, put that out to your students or recommend, you know, somebody who you would think would be a good fit? And I just said, yeah. And he said, okay, good. Well, here's the person you would call. And it was Betsy Felix, who was the assistant of Sam Salas, and Sam Salas was the headmaster. He said, have whoever you want, or you call, you know, Betsy Felix and talk to her, and, you know, send someone down for an interview. And I'm like, okay. And I wrote the number down, and I got off the phone, and I thought to myself, wow, maybe I'll call.
It's crazy.
Yeah. So I called some people I knew down in Detroit. And said, hey, this call came in, and there's this job at Cranbrook. And what's Cranbrook? Because I really didn't even know what it was. And my one friend's mom said, that is one of the most important schools in the history of design and art, and you should get down there as soon as you can. And so right then I thought, oh, okay, I'll do that.
I know, the innocence of and the bravery of a 22-year-old.
Right. I had never been on an interview before. I'd never really done any of that stuff, right? A serious interview. So I drove down to my parents' house in Harbor Springs, said, I'm going to go interview at Cranbrook. And my dad just kind of looked at me like, okay, what's next? You know, but I needed a suit. I needed some stuff to wear. So he lent me a suit and a tie, and I put this stuff on. And
were you guys about the same size?
Yeah, he was a little bit bigger than I was because he was a little heavier than I was at that point. So it didn't fit, of course, right? You can just visualize that. And so I went down for an interview in his suit and his tie, maybe even his shoes. I don't know, because I didn't have anything. I had nothing.
And nor did you have the money to buy it?
No, absolutely not. And so I went to the interview, and Sam Salas, who, first Betsy Felix, she was super cool, really nice. So gregarious and happy to see me. I don't think anybody's ever been that happy to see me. And it was a really strange feeling. It was like, wow, she's really happy to see me. And so I go and sit with Sam Salas, and he's a conservative guy, but a really nice guy, super gentle, very similar to my grandfather in demeanor. And he starts asking me, okay, so we're looking for someone to teach woodworking because Warren Pardon is going to retire. And, you know, is that something you think you can do? I'm like, oh, absolutely, I can do that. Absolutely. And he said, well, why do you think you can do it? Oh, because I've been doing furniture and blah, blah, blah. I love furniture and furniture and furniture and woodworking, 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 furniture, woodworking. And He just kind of looked at me, and I don't remember getting a read on it at all. I just remember talking a lot, like you're tap dancing, and
showing your excitement.
Yeah, I was. I was pretty passionate about it, yeah. Right? And he said, "Okay, well, that's good." He said, and then he leaned over on the desk, his arms, and he said, "Well, you're at Cranbrook. You know, if you teach at Cranbrook, you have to coach." And I said, "Okay." He said, "So, is there anything, any sports that you're really good at?" You know, and I'm thinking to myself, "No."
There's nothing?
Nothing, because I did some baseball for like 5 years when I was younger, but no football, no soccer, none, you know, basketball, none of that stuff, right? And because I was too busy being with my friends and hanging out. And we played scratch football and stuff like that, and hockey. We didn't really play organized things. And he said, "Well, Jim Meehan, who's been here about 7 years, has been coaching the ski team, the girls and the boys ski team, and he would like to change and not do the coaching anymore." And I said, "I can do that."
Did you know how to ski?
And I knew how to ski. Okay. I had been skiing for quite a while.
Oh, great.
You know, and I'm like, "Yeah, I can do that." And he said, "Okay." And that was the end of the interview. And then 2 days later, and I don't know how I got this message. I don't know where I was.
Yeah.
Maybe I was still down in Grosse Pointe in Detroit, and they reached me somehow, or maybe they called my parents. I don't know. Honestly, I don't know how. But I got the job.
Amazing.
And I was going to start in 2.5 weeks.
Jeez.
And Cranbrook, you know, they said, "The job is $13,000 to teach, and we provide you on-campus housing, and you eat in the cafeteria." Wow, that was huge. That was a lot of money, and I didn't have to find an apartment. So they gave me this really beautiful little apartment, and there I was, at Cranbrook, 23, had this apartment. I was teaching, and I mean, I walked into that shop, and I'm like, "Oh, this place is kind of nice." It was old. It wasn't new. It was old, and I didn't realize it at the time. I realized it later on. And I was told later on, which I didn't know, but the equipment that was in there, the joiner, planer, table saw, were Oliver's. That was a really powerful brand in the 30s and the 40s. And those that equipment all came out of St. Dunstan's at Cranbrook, which is where Charlie Eames and Errol Sarnan did their work for the organic show. And I was learned that later by some other people. But I didn't know it at the time. I just looked around the shop and like, okay, I got some work to do here. I had to fix it up. I had to clean it up. I had to get it going. So I, you know, immediately dug in and did what people do when they take over things. They just, some people, I guess, just reordered the shop. And then school started. I didn't know what I was going to do. I had no idea. Zero. I had no idea. I didn't have a teaching degree. I didn't know how to teach. I didn't know anything about anything about anything. Right, but I loved woodworking, and I knew how to work tools and the machinery. And so first we started, and the signups were kind of leftover people from Warren Pardon's program, and they would come in, and they wanted to build birdhouses and cutting boards, and I'm like, "That's a huge waste."
Did you say that?
Yeah. I remember saying it was a huge waste of material.
Yeah.
And it was a huge waste of creativity to limit yourself to this. I said, "We're going to do furniture here." And immediately, like, the eyes started to open up. And a number of the kids, or maybe it was 10 in the class, embraced it wholeheartedly.
And how old were these kids?
They were 17, 16. And they were all from, very well-to-do families. And it was kind of remarkable. They totally embraced the whole thing. And we just got into the shop, and I would just work with one kid to the next kid to the next kid to the next kid. And we would design it, and we'd model it, and then we'd build it. And I just stayed with them. We would just do it, and we just kept doing it. And pretty quickly, by the next semester or the semester after that, it had caught on, and then there was a lot of kids that wanted to be in the class, boys and girls. And so I felt fortunate because I had a lot of demand for the program. And as the demand grew, my enthusiasm grew. And as my enthusiasm grew, the demand grew. And so eventually it turned into, like, furniture design, slash woodworking, and technical drawing, which is what I taught also, and theory of architecture. They allowed me to develop this curriculum for a theory of architecture class using the buildings as my text. And so we would go to building and talk about these incredible buildings at Cranbrook and just critique them inside and out all day long. And it was fascinating. I mean, I've heard from a number of students that that was their first foray into analytical thinking. And for me, that's, you know, that feels great, obviously, you know, after investing that much time and energy. But you're young and you have the energy. You have the fire in the belly. And I wanted to make a difference, and I was not going to fail. And there was, you know, no other option but to put myself all in. And that's what I did.
I mean, it's amazing. It just sounds so extraordinary. And I'm surprised that you didn't keep on staying a professor.
Well, yeah, but it was a burn. I mean, teaching is really hard work when you're doing it all in. And at the same time I was doing this at Cranbrook, I was spending as much time as I could at the Cranbrook Academy of Art, which is just a graduate school, not an undergraduate. And I was kind of befriending some of these people. Most of them were resentful that I was there because they had, you know, basically cut off their ankle and their wrist to get there. And so who was this kid just kind of hanging around? Why is he hanging around? I mean, he didn't get accepted here. He's not one of the chosen ones. Why is he hanging around? But I was persistent. I just kept hanging around the library because there was so much wealth in that little library. And I just kept going there at nights and read. I didn't have a lot of friends, you know, at that point. Went down in Bloomfield Hills because I was young and there weren't a lot of young people. So I would spend a lot of time in the library studying, reading up, studying, and reading Avatari, reading Domus, reading these, you know, European magazines and learning about this new world that didn't exist for me at Northern. And so I would hang out in the academy and I did meet a couple people and I met one good friend, Ken Smith, and he was a bit of an outlier there as well. Because he was kind of conservative, and most of the people there were not conservative. And we became friendly, and so I'd hang out there. And as I hung out there more and more, Michael McCoy, the head of the department, would see me, and he knew what I was doing, and he would ask me how things are going, and eventually he said, you know, you should apply. Yeah, although he doesn't make the final decision. It's a group decision. And I said, well, I don't really know if I can get into this place because it's a pretty heavy place. And he said, work on your portfolio, try to get some more pieces in there and apply. And so I did, and I got accepted, which I just can't even kind of believe it today because you have this image in your head of these people who are there, and they play the part well, right? All these people that I was interacting with, right? They were all already successful industrial designers and product designers and graphic designers, and they were going to change the world and change the world and change the world. And man, that world was going to be changed. And so all of a sudden, and I always didn't quite put myself into those shoes until I got accepted. And then when I got accepted, I was like, now I'm playing with the big boys.
So you stopped teaching, obviously, and became a student again.
Right, because it felt like the next logical step. And teaching, yes, I could have done that the rest of my life at Cranbrook. Sure, I could have done that, but it wasn't...
You could have lived a very cushy life doing that.
Yeah, cushy, I mean, comfortable life.
I mean, not financially, but...
Comfortable.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they would send me in the summers on programs. They would always take care of you. It was a good place to work. They looked out for you, for sure. They took care of you. But there was also politics there. I was not in the inner circle at Cranbrook School for Boys either because I was kind of the strange bird, right? The strange guy that was doing woodworking and furniture design and cared about it so much. I mean, it was a little bit like, why does he care so much about this? And I did. And I was also coaching the ski team, and that was a really interesting experience, you know, because they were state champions. They were really good women's team, men's team, had long history of being super successful. And here I was, like, dropped up from a helicopter onto this, like, position as head coach of these teams. And that took a little bit of, you know, finagling, a little bit of tap dancing to get through. I got through it. We managed. We continued to be very, very successful all the way through. But it was a lot. I mean, you'd get up in the morning early, you teach all day, and you immediately get on a bus and you go out to Mount Holly and you'd be freezing your ass off and you'd be planning gates and you'd get home at 8 o'clock. You know, and that's really hard work.
Yes, it is. It's very hard work.
Even when you're young.
Yeah, no.
And so I didn't see that as like a real, I don't know, after like 3 or 4 years, I felt everything was kind of moving in cruise control after 3 years. And I felt maybe it's the entrepreneurial thing, right? You just grow tired of stuff. I don't know what it is. But eventually another door opened and I walked through it.
And you were able to. That's the amazing thing.
Yeah, I was able to. But it was a pretty heady time at Cranbrook. A lot of those alums have gone on to be very successful. And they came in with super strong intellectual skills of, you know, understanding the relationships of materiality and the functionality of different componentry. And so we get in these crits, you know, every single Friday, a crit, and they would have more juice on me because they had experienced more. I had more experience in one sector, but they had more experience in many sectors. And so I was outgunned in some ways. I felt outgunned by a lot of these guys. And maybe they just talked a good game. I'm not sure. Their work was pretty strong. I mean, the work that came out of that period is still talked about. So I see it as an opportunity for me. It was an opportunity for me to raise the bar.
It does force you to push your boundaries.
You can't show that you are low man on the totem pole in a place like that. Or even if you are or aren't, you can't show it, right? So you have to carry yourself with a certain amount of swagger. And you have to be able to perform. And you have to be able to talk in those crits. And you have to be a quick learner to know how to navigate those crits with some of these people who don't really want you to succeed. Their goal is not for you to succeed. Their goal is for them to succeed. And you may or may not be in their way.
What was it like being surrounded by people that, you know, you kind of felt intimidated by? I mean, emotionally, because some, you know, I know that doctors go through that a lot. In medical school, there's a lot of competition and there's a lot of one-upmanship, and sometimes emotionally they can't handle it. How was it for you?
It was fine, but I think I was kind of used to it being 5'6", you know, and, you know, not Prince Charming, you know, so I was kind of used to having to prove myself. I think that comes from the loss of my mother, and it caused this sense of wanting to prove myself and be successful in someone's eyes, right? But not knowing whose eyes, because I didn't have the mother, which is the most critical eyes that a child has. And so constantly I was on the move to be better, to do more, to be more successful. So in that environment, I think that it was not so foreign to me because I think I lived in that space for quite a while, and Cranbrook kind of just operated in that space.
So what were those first few weeks and months at Cranbrook like? Was it by the time you got there, you knew a lot about it.
I knew a lot about it. I knew about the physical plant. I knew about the rigor of the criteria that was going to be required, but you don't know until you're there. And when you're there, all of a sudden I found myself there. And all of a sudden I found myself with a lot of beehive activity all around me and feeling like I'm standing still because there was just so much motion all the time. And you had to present all the time. So it was tough. I mean, it was definitely tough. I remember being very challenged and excited at the same time because I was at Cranbrook. I was at Cranbrook, which is just amazing that I got into Cranbrook, you know. And here I was. I was at Cranbrook, Studio One, upstairs, design studio, and trying to move myself to the next level, which, you know, proved to be fairly complicated because the bar is so high there and the people that have come through those doors are so revered that you can't help but feel minuscule in a place like that, even if you are super strong and successful at a young age. So it worked me pretty hard, and it pushed me really hard.
Yeah. How long were you there for?
2 years.
And would you say that, you know, your skills just sort of skyrocketed?
My intellectual capabilities of analytical dialogue skyrocketed.
Which in turn changed the quality of your work, I'm sure.
To translate that into work is the hardest part, because to think about it, to read about it, to talk about it is one thing, but to translate that into work is very, very difficult, because at Cranbrook, there are no boundaries. You're there to do your work, pass, fail. And if you don't do your work and it's not at the level that it needs to be commiserate with Cranbrook, then you're gone. You're done. You're not at Cranbrook anymore. And no one along the way is saying, that's maybe not so good, or, that's really great. You'd have the crits, but you never knew where you stood. You were always on sand at Cranbrook until the very end. Yeah, and that's what it felt like. You were just a shifting tectonic plate of design moving underneath your feet, and you just didn't know where you stood on that.
And I'm sure everyone else felt that way, too.
You'd never know it. I bet you if I met them today and talked to them, they would probably say the same thing.
What did you have to do to graduate from Cranbrook?
The most important thing you had to do at Cranbrook is that you had to produce all the way along the best you could, and you had to present your graduate show and write a thesis. Those two things, you had to present in the graduate show and write the thesis, and by God, it had better be good. Because if it's not good, it's going to be the most embarrassing moment of your whole life, because you won't graduate. So,
did that actually happen? Did people actually not graduate?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. People were asked to leave, for sure. And I always thought that I might be right on that precipice, that at any time this could be taken away, right, for me. There was no guarantee. I never felt like there was a guarantee at Cranbrook, like, oh, you're in, so you're going to graduate. It was like, you're in, now you got to graduate.
It's very exciting.
Yeah, it is pretty exciting.
So what did you do for your final project?
I made a remarkably, after months and months and months of banging my head against the wall, of Michael McCoy, the instructor, looking at me like, you better figure this out. Months of this, right? And somehow, again today, this is crazy, but the phone rang at the studio, and I was working with these little pieces of model material, some of this stainless, some of this wood, some of these things. I was just kind of morphing these ideas of trying to get this. I was working on this trompe l'oeil idea of the ephemeral nature of referential furniture. That's what was all about for me at that particular point in my life. And so I had this little perf material. It was scaled, though. It wasn't like real perforated metal. It was just from the model shop. And I was playing with it, and the phone rang. I don't remember who called me, and I jumped up to go grab it, and so I went and came back. And I came back to my desk, and somehow these two planes had landed right next to each other and formed this chair. And I looked down and I saw it, and I just stopped. And I looked at it, and I couldn't believe what I was seeing, because it kind of somehow encapsulated exactly what I was trying to get to, but couldn't get to for months, literally months. And there it was. And I remember this feeling, this like wave, this feeling coming over me like,
I've got this, I've got it.
I had to walk away, right? Walk away from it, because it was like almost... like, oh my God, I can't believe this.
You were so overwhelmed.
I was pretty overwhelmed, because I felt like this is it. This isn't the test case. This isn't the test case. This is the real thing. And so I started putting it together with the hot glue gun and going back, changing the scale, and it came in. It just metamorphosized into this chair, this perforated steel corner chair, because I was trying to it was postmodern period, and I was toggling the postmodern. So the corner chair, you know, being of the, you know, basic, the regal period of that was happening 200, 300 years before. And so I did this corner chair, and it was perforated steel. And then I found this magnetic material and cut out the Chippendale and the Hepplewhite and the different motifs that represented their particular signature style. And it adhered to the perforated steel on the back side of the perf because it was magnetic. And it created this shadow effect, this outline of historical referencing of, you know, this furniture. And
interesting.
It really worked out. It really worked out well. And I was just so proud of myself that this had happened. It happened 30 days before the show, right?
Jeez.
And I'd already been working on my thesis, so I knew in my head what I was trying to say, and it all just lined up, perfectly lined up.
And it was by mistake.
Pretty much.
It sounds like a piece that Capellini would take on. Is that true?
Well, yes and no. I mean, possibly it would have been something Capellini was interested in. Ironically, Shiro Kuramata designed a chair for Vitra called How High the Moon Chair, which is in a similar language 2 years later. So anytime I show that chair to anybody, they're like, oh, dude, nice. Little influence from Shiro. And I'm like, well, it actually is 2 years before him. And they're like, mm-hmm, okay, next. So it's a bit
That's
of a...
That's very funny.
Yeah, so yes, the design really worked out well. Mm-hmm. Of course, it needed to be worked further because, you know, in that period of time, you really have to work with these things and keep maturing them And the evolution of the product generally gets better unless you screw it up somewhere along the way. And I needed more time to do that. But for the student show and for graduation, I felt like I nailed it.
Did your teacher feel like you did, your advisor?
No one ever says that. No one ever said, great job, that I remember, right? Or maybe I was just, my head was too much in the clouds. I don't remember. But it seemed like in that generation, and McCoy was kind of part of that generation, there wasn't a lot of, I'm proud of you, or great job, or you are really fabulous, right? There just wasn't a lot of that going on. It was like, mm-hmm. Here's your degree. That should be good enough.
Amazing. And I guess it is. I mean, like, it is good enough because it's the stamp of approval.
In a way, that's why there isn't a lot of accolade that comes from, you know, all the faculty, right? They're all fairly reserved in their mannerisms and how they approached your work. Or they weren't that excited about my work. I have no idea. But I was excited about it. I felt like it nailed what I was trying to accomplish. It was completely out of my medium. It was perforated steel. It wasn't wood. It wasn't about joinery. It wasn't about the materiality per se. It was about the language. And that was critical. That was a big turning point for me from the step of, you know, designer craftsman to designer furniture designer.
Yeah, I mean, when I think about the concepts behind it, just from what you've briefly said here, it makes sense that now you have something like Architectura that represents and reflects all these different styles and ways of thinking around design. In that piece, there was a complexity to the thinking in the sense that you weren't just thinking about creating something within one style. You were thinking about looking at something through the lens of history and all the different styles that had come before it in a certain way. Is that right. At all accurate?
No, that's accurate. I mean, in true context, it was the period of postmodern, right? So there was that kind of baggage lingering around. But that is accurate.
In the sense that the bridge from doing that to what you do now seems less complicated and it seems more natural.
Certainly is certainly more natural. I wouldn't have known it at the time. I know it now because it seems in the correct lineage of where I was heading, right? And yes, the work that I sell today and represent today is clearly of that mindset, or it wouldn't be in Architectura,
mm-hmm.
or it wouldn't be at B&B, or it wouldn't be at Casino, or it wouldn't be at Patrona Frau.
Yeah, you may not make things anymore, But Cranbrook shaped everything that you do now.
Absolutely. But it all shaped everything I do now. You know, even Northern, even Laney, all of it, you know, is pretty much a pyramid to where I sit today.
So you presented that thesis at the end. Did you finally feel on par with your colleagues?
Yes, I did. I felt I walked out of that school a different person than I walked in. And I felt like perhaps my path and my growth was more fertile than some of the other people because they came in with a different expectation, and maybe that expectation was based on their previous experiences. And so they came in expecting to achieve X, and they started at a certain point. But I feel like I started at a lower point, but maybe went beyond that point. Possibly. I mean, well, I don't know. I'm going to get killed for saying that.